So I thought, following Sam, I would begin with a sort of a five-minute cute little thing before doing the real talk. So sometimes we find ourselves in a position where we have something we call training data. And training data might be pairs of points in a high-dimensional space. So I've got one high-dimensional space along here, which I'm calling images. Let's say it's 40 dimensions. I've downsampled my images somehow, or represented them somehow. And I've got another dimension here, which I might call something like pose. So I might want to perform a regression task. Look at an image and say, what are the joint angles of the human body present in the image? So I might say, oh yeah, right, I'm going to solve that problem. Here's my training data. Well, what do I really want? I want sort of conditional densities over pose condition on images Z. So I might somehow fit the joint density of the training examples, and it doesn't matter how you do it. You can probably guess this isn't a Gaussian mixture, this is a Gaussian process latent variable model, but it doesn't really matter what you do. You say you have some representation of the manifold on which your training examples lie, and once you have that representation, then you can maybe slice it vertically and discover that corresponding to this image here, there are one, two possible poses for the bimodal distribution. Okay, but the problem is, I said at the start, we were in high dimensions, not the two dimensions shown on the screen. So we don't have this, right? What we actually have is something a bit more like this, because the points are very much further apart in high dimensions, and it was pretty expensive to label all those images, especially if you're doing regression. So what are we going to do? Well, we're going to try the same trick to fit our manifold, and we can get lots of different answers, but here's one perfectly reasonable answer for the Gaussian process latent variable model. It's kind of resting on its prior a bit. It's saying it's a linear mapping with some fat variance. Now we're in trouble, because if we look at image down here, it doesn't tell us give us the bimodal conditional that we wanted from before. It gives us this unimodal condition in exactly the wrong place. So what are we going to do? Well, it's very simple. We use the data that we don't have. The reason that we're in trouble is because we don't have enough training data. Right? We can't get any more. If we could, we would pay for it. What we can easily do is get lots and lots of images without unlabeled images. So we just get images of people doing the same sort of exercise routine. But we don't bother to mark them up. We can also go to CMU and download loads of motion capture data, so we can get loads of examples of the joint angles from this class of motions that we're interested in, or whatever it is we're fitting. Okay, and hooray. Now we know the marginals of this density, and this is where Sam's trick, or a continuous variation of it, is. So if we know the marginals of this, effectively we can gather so much training data that we know the marginals. And if we do know the marginals, we can look back at our earlier guess, given the limited training data, and we can find out that in orange, these are the marginals of the earlier guess. It's correctly predicted the density over joint angles, but it hasn't correctly predicted the density over images. There's a bunch of mass out here that isn't properly explained. So what do you do? Well, you just fit the density while including the marginal samples, and this is what you get. So this is yet another sort of equally likely density over the joint samples here, but because it's constrained to keep all its mass out of the way, in these areas to the left and right of the main lobe, the only thing you can do is get over here, explain these points, take a quick swerve back over here, and it's got something like the actual true underlying density. And that's it. So that's the thing you get with 10 joint samples and 100 marginals in each dimension. This is the original density we got when we had 100 joint samples, so they're kind of roughly saying the same sort of thing. They're certainly good enough for the application we want, which is we want to condition on a given image set and just get a list of the modes over joint angles so that we get ambiguous answers. This is just showing you the same thing run on many different versions of this trial. So we've got 10 joint samples, 100 marginal samples, showing you that a lot of the time it gives you something which will work, i.e. give you a list of something that looks like the original density, with more and more variously disastrous failures as you, depending, because the way you do it is you do a nonlinear estimation of the missing data problem. Right, that's kind of a talk. Okay, so I'll leave that back there, and then does anyone want me to talk more about this, or shall I go on to the other stuff? Does anyone have any questions or observations or anything?
Well, you didn't give a solution, Sam gave a solution. Is that what you're
going to
do in a bit?
Yeah, the solution will be of the class of the one that I'm going to discuss next. But basically, you throw in the missing data and you optimize the same function as you were optimizing, but with zero weights for the stuff that you don't know.
So how do you decide on the
Excellent. Correct question. We always set it to 100th. exactly. Because the samples aren't actually drawn from this model, if I use the marginal data very, very strongly, I'll fit to the marginal, I'll drag, you know, because the model's not going to fit exactly, I'll drag it away and go wrong. So. Right, next topic. Okay, so this is what I said I was going to talk about. We have somehow a model whereby a large low-rank matrix M was generated by taking a tall, thin matrix A, a portrait matrix A, and multiplying it by a landscape matrix B transpose. And from the world, we have captured some observations of this large matrix M, which we call large matrix M hat, which we call M. With those observations, we had some confidence measure. So for every element of M, we have a corresponding matrix W of the same size, and every element of W basically tells you how confident you are in the measurement in M. In particular, we'll be looking at matrices W where the weights are 0 or 1. 1 if you found a measurement at location ij and 0 otherwise. And the task we want to solve is we want to compute the minimum over the unknown matrices A and B of this objective. So difference between our observation M and our unknowns AB transpose viewed through the lens of or the window of this mass matrix W, where this dot in a circle product is just a Hadamard or direct product. Element-wise matrix product, dot star in MATLAB. Fine, okay, because, you know, it's after lunch, I'll give you some pretty pictures as to why you might want to do that, but I know really all you want to do is solve this, so scribble this down. Have a go at solving it, and when we finish the pretty pictures, then you can tell me what you came up with. Has everyone got a scribble done? I see you're still scribbling.
It's weighted SVD. It's weighted SVD.
It sure is.
No, it'd be hard.
Indeed, it's tricky. But these scribblings are waiting.
So is W 1 when you know it, or 0?
Sorry?
W is 1 when it's known about it?
Yes, 1 is known. Yeah. Why would you mind?
Sorry, good question. Are you assuming that the data that's missing in the that model is missing at random?
We'll get to that. If it were, it would be trivial. Sorry. If we were missing uniformly at random, it's much easier. I'll talk a little bit about how that's not true in the real world and how that changes things. Why might you want to do it? Well, there are lots of computer vision examples where I might want to characterize the motion of the tracks on this graph. I'm not really going to show you how these turn into numbers. I'm just going to show you some pretty pictures. I might want to do some giraffe processing. If I do that, then maybe I can make pictures where I take a giraffe and put text on its back, and the text moves in a way that, this is very, very, very preliminary results in a way that is roughly, it looks like it's stuck to the giraffe. So I also wanted to preempt Jan saying, but wasn't this work done in 1998, by now showing some work that was done in 1998. So you might want to take a video like this one. yeah, that's right. It had more pixels back then, but you know, they've decayed over time. So you might have a video, you might have a video like this one. You might do a sort of a process where you track points from frame to frame through the video. You might represent each of these yellow lines as a pair of rows in our matrix W. Right? So each track is a row with entries just, pair of rows, x, y, x, y, x, y, tracked along the matrix. And there'll be zeros because you can see that although these tracks should form full ellipses, they in fact just form little segments of ellipses. So you imagine each row of the matrix is going to have little chunks of known information and lots of unknown information. If you did that, you could probably build a representation of the sequence, which is something like this. Now this is actually done with a non-linear, a harder problem than the one I'm going to talk about today, but you can build a representation of something like this, where you've got sort of three-dimensional points and a view of what the cameras did. And if you did that, then you could build a representation of something like this, where you've got a sort of three-dimensional re-rendering of the stuff that happened in the video, and now you can view that from viewpoints that weren't in the original video. So those are all things you can do if you can solve big matrix factorization problems. So you're asking about W and what the entries look like. Well, for the sequences that I'm looking at there, and this is another example of photometric stereo. So for the draft sequence, we have points on the back draft, okay, and each row of this matrix, or pair of rows, is, you know, the lifetime of one point as it moves through the sequence. Sorry, each column is the lifetime of one point. And you can see here there's a big white patch of missing data, where, if you remember, the back giraffe is occluded by the front giraffe. So he walks behind the front giraffe, and each track gets broken, so it goes missing. Here's an application that I didn't talk about, but here's a sort of an easy case where you can see that the missing elements are almost distributed uniformly at random. And here's the dinosaur case, where you can see that each individual trajectory lives, so each column here, you can think of as a single one of those trajectories.
Well, sorry, I was just going to ask if were the W's in this case generated automatically, or did someone?
Right hand two automatic, left hand one partially manual. Don't know much about the left hand one. So each column here represents one track, and you can see that the tracks live for really a very short time. So the typical track might, there are 36 frames of that video, the typical track might live for 6 frames or something. Okay, so back to our problem statement. We had this low rank matrix M. We know how it got made. We want to minimize this objective. So is this hard? Well, you can do it two ways. You can say, is this hard? Sam will tell you this is hard, and that will be good. I'll forget about the extension to move on. There are lots of local minima. So here's just a random slice through a two-dimensional slice through the objective function, just showing that projected onto these two dimensions, there are spiky local minima. We may want to deal with extensions of this problem. So, for example, I was looking at a Frobenius norm squared. If the person who was giving you your matrix has made some mistakes, then you might want a more robust norm, like you might want L1, or just in general a robust kernel rho wrapped around here. And you'll almost certainly want priors on the matrices A and B. But for the moment, I'm going to ignore those. At the very end, I'll mention them and tell you that they don't change the story very much. Okay. As somebody said on Monday, of course, the problem has an inherent gauge freedom. For a given solution A and B, for a given pair of matrices A and B, the error function doesn't change if I post-multiply A by some invertible matrix and post-multiply B by the inverse transpose of that invertible matrix. Or equivalently, the error function is the same here and here. So one, we may care about that, we may not. In this work, I'm never going to care about it because all I want to do is find one of that equivalence class of A's and B's that is the global optimum. Okay, so what are the algorithms you can use to solve this problem? There's a very beautiful algorithm, which I can explain in a break if someone wants, which is based on subspace carving. Essentially, it's closed form, but it's got hideous complexity and doesn't work for any problems that we've tried. There's a family which I shall refer to as the alternation family, which I'll explain, and if you were doing your homework during the pretty videos, you've probably invented an alternation algorithm. Another class of algorithms called imputation, and there's a sort of an obvious and dumb thing to do, which, as we heard yesterday, may not be so dumb, which is just throw epsilon into a nonlinear optimizer. So I'm going to go through what they do, talk about the performance, and then maybe try to draw a picture of the relationship between algorithm 2 and 4. Okay, so what's the alternation algorithm? This is the objective we want to minimize. I've dropped the W for the moment, right? I assure you it's not going to make any difference. It just makes everything very, very messy. It's not going to make any difference to the derivation. It makes a massive difference to the answer. But we can look at the derivation without the W's, and it sort of stays printable. So you immediately observe that if you know B, we know N anyway, if you know B, this is just quadratic in A. So you can take your objective, differentiate with respect to A. You get an expression something like this. And then you solve this expression. You set this expression to 0. Do some simple manipulations, and you end up with an expression that says A equals M times the transpose of the pseudo-inverse of B. So it's incredibly simple. You can just perform this computation. Fix B, compute A, then you fix A, using fix to the new A and recompute B, and you get an iteration, an alternation of these two steps, which lots of people call EM-like steps, or sometimes they call them EM steps. And you can do that until A and B starts changing. And often people like the fact that there's a progress guarantee. Every time you do this, you're guaranteed to not make the original objective function worse. So that's a happy algorithm. There's another class of algorithms where you sort of guess the missing entries of the initial matrix M. We know that there's an SVD solution in the case of non-missing data, so you take M0, factorize it using SVD to give you some new answers, and now you use your new guess to fill in, to improve your guess of the missing entries. I'm not going to say much more about it, except that effectively it is in the same class as the alternation methods in terms of convergence. Okay, so this is a popular algorithm. In fact, here is a random selection of the 40 or so papers which propose alternation algorithms. And what we've done here is made it easy for you to survey the literature. Basically, you assemble these 11 in between steps using an 11-bit binary vector. And as you can see, although I said there were 40 papers, there are still 2 to the 11 minus 40 to be published on this subject. So it's a popular algorithm. And you know, they all have very variously different performance characteristics, but they're all the same. Not the same algorithm, just that, you know, they perform roughly the same. So, of course, while I was chatting, the people who really wanted to solve it just shoved it into MATLAB's fmin unc. They just wrote down the objective, differentiated it a couple of times, and used a second-order algorithm, like a Newton algorithm, to optimize. And that's the thing I'm going to go into in a bit of detail later, so at the moment I'll just do it at a high level. And you can fiddle with the optimizer to get yourself a progress guarantee. So it'll take the function, search over A and B, go downhill. And then the final thing you can try, and I'll show you why in a bit, I hope, is you can do a couple of steps of alternation just to get yourself somewhere near a better optimum, and then switch between alternation and Newton, however you like. The one I prefer is 3 steps of alternation, then do Newton. But you know, you can try lots and lots of hybrid algorithms, and we've tried lots, and they all work roughly the same. You'll find that throughout this talk, I never give you a sort of this algorithm works best recommendation, but I will tell you that what I do is a few steps of alternation and then Newton, so on most problems I think that's the thing to do. Okay, so before I go into any more detail, how do the algorithms perform? And again, you know, there's a big question of how am I really, really going to get a sensible characterization of how these algorithms perform? Any method I propose, I can almost propose any method to make any ordering of the algorithms. It's not strictly true, but what I'm actually going to do is show you one typical run. Okay? So this is a single problem, the dinosaur problem, a single random initialization, and a few algorithms, some of which I haven't described to you or I haven't really discussed yet. And I'm telling you that roughly on average, this is the kind of thing that might happen. And I'm going to tell you how often the labels will switch. So here's your alternation algorithm, this red line at the bottom. And typically what happens with an alternation algorithm is it makes a lot of progress. This is time. Makes a lot of progress, you know, over the first while. And then after a certain point, its first order convergence means that it just flatlines. Right? So this is still going down. It's just if I let this go to 2,000 years, it may even come down to, you know, where some of these guys are, it may even come down here, we don't know. In practice, you're going to cut the thing off after a certain number of iterations or a certain amount of time. Okay. Another algorithm that you might use, Damp Newton, haven't fully described it yet, we'll do in a minute, has the property that it sort of messes around for a while, hyperspacing to silly places on the error surface. Eventually it jumps itself to a new random starting point, and pegs downhill unbelievably quickly. So down here it really is flat. It's not going to get any deeper. And how do we know that? Because the Hessian is strongly positive definite, or not negative definite. And then here are some other performance curves. So a hybrid algorithm does alternation for a bit, and then maybe gets down to wherever this red line is going, maybe a bit sooner. Okay. So that's the rough thing. What I want you to take from this picture is alternation will get somewhere, and then it just flatlines and isn't going to get you any further.
So what does the model look like in this problem?
Sorry, say
local
again?
Minima are not a problem?
Local minima are a problem. In fact, you might ask, how often from random restarts do you end up in the global minimum? Right? Because and you may have cleverer restart strategies, but if you've only got one restart strategy, you're stuffed. Right? So you have to think of a restart strategy that will generate you good initial estimates, so you have some chance of finding a global optimum. And until the last 2 slides, I'm going to assume that that we really want to find a global optimum. I certainly have no interest in stopping early or not finding it. I really want to write down my energy, find a global optimum. If I make a mistake, fix the energy. Okay, so who finds the global optimum? So what are these pictures? I'll do the middle one first. All right. So this is on this easy data set, the face data set. We've done 1,000 runs of the algorithm, and the x-axis here is simply value of optimum, value of the error function found. And then the all I've done is taken my 1,000 runs, sorted them by error function value. So I've got something a bit like a histogram or a cumulative histogram of who ended up where. So what's this telling us? At the far left, because we've run this thing by now billions of times, we're pretty confident that this is the global optimum for this problem. So what this picture is showing is that 350 times out of the 1,000, the black algorithm, Damp-Newton, got to the global optimum. That's pretty surprising, because this is a smallish problem. It's in maybe 20,000 dimensions or something. 35% of the time from random restarts, it found the global optimum. That basin of convergence is absolutely massive. It's all, 35% is almost all the space. The hybrid method, the one I'm going to recommend to you at the end, finds the global optimum in 15% of trials. And in this case, alternation never found the global optimum on these 1,000 runs. Okay, here's another sequence, and I'll explain in the next couple of slides, what makes some of these hard and some of these easy. Draft sequence, Damp-Newton loves it. Oh, sorry, no, Damp-Newton hates it. So in only, that's 50 out of 500, so, in 5% of runs or something, Damp-Newton actually finds the global optimum. Draft sequence, alternation, and the hybrid both love it, so 35% of the time, they end up at the global optimum. Dinosaur sequence, close to worst case, very common case, but close to worst case in terms of the size, the layout of W. So the dinosaur sequence, Damp-Newton's okay, so out of 1,000 runs, 4% of the time it gets there. Yeah, that's not so bad. 100 random restarts, you've got some decent chance of finding global optimum. Alternation gets there less frequently, and again, hybrid gets there less frequently. Alternation doesn't have a chance on this algorithm, on this data. Okay, so what is it about these?
Just a quick question. How are you sure that you're finding global optimum? Is the Damp-Newton's got some smart strategy of rolling across the hills like simulated anemia?
No.
Or how do you want to go?
No, all I want to do is get downhill. I want to get to the nearest
so
local.
So it's
going to
be dependent on where you start.
Absolutely. So random starting positions. So all I'm saying is if you do random starting positions, the various numbers I was quoting, 4% of the time or 35% of the time, you'll end up at the global optimum.
There may be a teeny weeny weeny basin 1 billionth of a time, that's all you're saying to me. But you still haven't seen our probability.
Oh, yeah. Are we sure this is the global optimum? We have a number of other hacking strategies.
All three algorithms at the same point.
Yes.
You're saying that some of the gradient methods will get stuck in some local optimums and the Damp-Newton will actually cross those local optimums and get to the global one?
No, but I'm saying a few things. Okay, there's a good set of answers to that. First thing, Newton is disastrous far from the optimum. So the first few steps of Newton will be just almost random jumps. Damp-Newton's slightly different, but pure Newton, just random jumps. It's going to look at the Hessian, invert it, the thing may not even be positive definite. It'll go off in hyperspace, okay? Ignoring those situations for a moment, because they're kind of just a different random restart. If you start all these algorithms at the same point, and they have a positive definite Hessian, they should all go to the same local optimum. Right? That should happen. Except that if you turn them off, if you give them a limited amount of time, a lot of the time the alternation algorithms won't get nearby optimum. Right?
So all the results that you showed is just you have fixed number of iterations.
Exactly.
And you say that
exactly. A sort of a plausible number of a plausible amount of time that we wish to spend.
So your graph just
Olivia,
I don't understand your comment. Why should they get to the same optimum, local optimum, if you start at the same point? I mean, if you have like different minimization method, they have no reason to arrive at the same local minimum.
But they're all really going downhill.
Let's say standard gradient descent versus conjugate gradient. I mean, for sure, like most of the time, they won't be at the same local minimum. It's like it depends on how is your. I mean, if your objective function is very complex, right?
But yes, I agree. If the objective function is very complex, but imagine that you're on something which is loosely quadratic, right? Which because we're doing lots and lots of random restarts, right? We want to know all of this applies only when you're near the quadratic basin, and this is true no matter what you do, okay? And in that case, they're all going to end up. There's only one optimum nearby. You know, the Hessian is positive definite now at an optimum, at a given optimum. Now, draw the region of space where the Hessian remains positive definite, and you've got a basin of convergence around that optimum.
I don't think it's true for your case, right?
No. And the graphs I just showed show that, in fact, they do jump to different places.
Yeah.
But what I'm trying to say is that this is not really a talk about how often you get to the optimum. It's a talk about how fast you get there. Because how fast you get there affects things like how many random restarts you can do. And it's silly to be near the optimum and not getting there, which is what happens if you do a first-order method. And you'll notice that I'm not talking about conjugate gradient here, which falls between the pure critical sensitile methods and the second-order methods. Wait, so, okay. Is it just completely confusing now, or does anyone want to summarize it? Okay. It's about getting to the nearest local optimum quickly. You don't always guarantee to find the nearest local optimum for various things like hyperspacing with Newton. But what you really don't want to do is use these attractive closed form alternation schemes, because they get you to the nearest optimum extremely slowly. Okay, I'll move on. We'll discuss it later. Okay, so let's look at some. I'm going very fast. Right. Let's look at some. What makes the problems hard or easier? What affects where you end up? Here is a matrix where the white entries are missing. So this is an almost full matrix. And what I'm showing is the residuals, so the difference M minus AB transpose. They all look the same, that's intentional. After performing some minimization from some standard starting point or from some starting point using various algorithms, the top row shows the residuals multiplied by the weight matrix, and the bottom row shows the residuals against the ground truth. Black is good. Okay, so what this is saying, for this case, all three algorithms give you black pictures. So they all converge fine. The bad case happens when your weight matrix is all, actually there are some small weights in there which you can't see, which is almost completely, okay. In this case, black is 1. Sorry about that. So here we have a weight matrix, which is two blocks, which are almost entirely not linked to each other. Okay, black is 1. Yes, that's correct. Okay. Out here are a couple of samples which link these two blocks. If we perform the minimization without these samples, there's absolutely no reason that it should get the off-diagonal blocks right, because there's nothing to relate the entries down here with the entries up here. So if you perform the optimization here, you've got a very difficult, very sinuous minimization, or a sort of long, narrow valley. So alternation, in this case, these are the residuals that the algorithm can see. These are the residuals that it can't see. So in this case, alternation can't even minimize the visible stuff well, right? So we've got bright stuff here saying that it didn't even get the smallest possible set of residuals on the data that we can see. And then if we look at the error with respect to the ground truth, well, of course, it can't get it in these off-diagonal blocks. Okay, so this is the distinction that you are making. This is the error function, essentially. This is test performance. So minimize the error. Doesn't do a bad job of that. Of course, it does bad on test. The hybrid method does a little bit better at minimizing the error, still does a lousy job of predicting the off-diagonal terms. Right? In this case, the damp Newton method, and this is where the damp Newton is good, is making use of little coupling information, actually manages to get low test error and low training error and low test error. So
I'm confused about the low test error. You don't have any data to compare against in the algorithms. How can possibly get that?
Sorry, synthetic examples here.
Well, I understand that.
Yeah.
So what is black and then mean?
Black in the off-diagonal blocks means there is some data there.
Okay.
Something linking the.
Your damp Newton There is some ground truth that the algorithm doesn't have any knowledge of access to, and yet it still reproduces it.
Yes. And that's what it should do. I mean, certainly in the easy cases, that's exactly what we expect. We expect, because this matrix is low rank. We have that constraint. So we really expect to fill in, you know, if we can see all but a rank by n rectangle and a rank by m rectangle up here, we should be able to reconstruct the rest of the matrix. And then the question is how well we actually do that. Okay, and then completely decoupled problem. So there's no black out here. They're all now it's very easy again. Now it's just solving two subproblems which are exactly the same. So there's no coupling between them. Gets low residual here and here. All algorithms do the same, and none of them, of course, have any chance of predicting what's out here. Because if you imagine the column space here and the column space here are completely disjoint, so you just find low rank representations for each of those. Okay, so now I'm going to go into what actually happens. I'm going to go into why alternation algorithms actually do quite well, and why, if you tell your student, go and do a second order algorithm, they'll come back and say, yeah, I did it, but you know, it didn't really give me that much advantage, and you know, it wasn't really worth it, and it was a real pain to do the derivatives. Okay, so, and the other thing is, people will say, well, I can't be bothered doing a Downing algorithm because there's an n cubed inversion in there. And you know, that's going to take forever, and I'm not going to do that. So I just want to remind you that really the alternation is just a special case of Newton. So you can, so certainly the arguments that it's slower can be controlled. You can control the amount by which it's slower. Slower, I mean per iteration. Number of iterations will likely be smaller. The time plots I showed you all had real time on the x-axis, not number of iterations, because they will differ a lot. Who knows how the Newton method works? Who can derive the Newton method? Okay, I'm going to say that's half. So those of you who can. And those of you who didn't put up your hands, if you know, well, you know, it's your fault. Okay, what's the Newton method? I'll just go through it quickly. I have a function f of multivariate x. I've been given a starting guess x0. And I want to find a new set of parameters such that f of x prime is lower than f of x0. And ideally, f of x prime is going to be the lowest it could be. The way I'm going to find my new x prime is I'm going to find an update vector, which when added to x, gives me a lower value of f. I believe that I'm in a regime where f's derivatives tell me something about its shape. So I Taylor expand f at x0 plus u is its value at x0 plus the gradient times u plus the Hessian times, so that's a chunk here, the matrix of second derivative, times u transpose u. Written that up again here so we can see it, and I'm writing it as gradient dot producted with u plus half u transpose hu. And this is what we want to minimize now to find a new value of u. And if you work it all out, you'll find that the minimum of this occurs at u equals minus h inverse g. So jump down the gradient by an amount proportional to the inverse of the Hessian, the matrix of second derivatives. What do we know when we're at numerical analysis 101? What are we told? Near the optimum, this gives you very fast convergence. It gives you the convergence that conjugate gradient would really have if it knew what the full Hessian was. What it also has is no progress guarantee. Right? So f of x prime, we're going to do this random thing. It really, unlike the closed form part of the alternation computation, which guaranteed to reduce the energy every time, this Hessian is not right, this gradient isn't right, it doesn't, you know, the function is not quadratic. So x prime could just be somewhere random else in space. Right? So there's absolutely no guarantee that this will give you a reduced function value. Which is why you do damp Newton, which is a sort of a very simple trust region method, where you say, okay, what I do know, times you can be pretty sure this is going to send you off into hyperspace are if the Hessian is not positive definite. That's likely to put you in trouble. So what you do is you add a big chunk of identity, lambda times the identity to the Hessian, and that's, you know, lambda big enough, that's going to make that positive definite. And if you look at that, so it's definitely going to condition it. And if you look at what happens when lambda goes towards infinity, well, really, lambda times identity takes over, and the step becomes 1 over lambda times the gradient. So as lambda gets bigger and bigger, you're just doing a tiny, tiny step downhill. You're measuring the gradient direction and going, let's say, 1e minus 16 along the gradient. And if that doesn't make the function smaller, you're basically, you're at a saddle or you're at an extremum, you're at a saddle or an optimum. So we have here an algorithm which now, with a suitable strategy for updating lambda, does guarantee progress, because eventually lambda just goes off to very high and you just go down the gradient. Right, so what exactly is the strategy? This is a simple version of Damp-Newton. This will work. This is a plausible, you know, not a bad thing to implement. There are lots and lots, there have been 40 years of numerical analysis on how to make second order optimizers work better. But this just gives you a picture of what the performance should be and what. So what do? You set your guess to the initial estimate that they gave you, choose a value of lambda, really doesn't matter what you choose here, and our convergence criterion is lambda has got very large. If lambda's got very large, that means you're moving tiny distances down the gradient and getting nowhere, you may as well stop. Take your value x, compute the Hessian and the gradient, compute the Damp-Newton update, and now you've got two things can happen. Either your new estimate is bad, right? That means you kind of trusted the Hessian too much, you went off into hyperspace. So what you do is you say, I'm going to go around this loop again, but this time I'm going to try lambda being larger. And if lambda's larger, I'm going to be more like gradient descent, so the next time around, maybe I'll get a good answer, a good estimate. If you were successful, then you say, oh, that's great, the Hessian is trustworthy for this value of lambda. What I might even try to do is decrease lambda by a little bit, right? Because the smaller lambda is, the more I'm doing Hessian, pure Hessian updates, and the faster they're likely to be if I'm in a long, narrow valley. And then you can loop this around. So I'm not telling you this is what is implemented in any industrial strength optimizer, but I'm saying if you implement this, you'll get the sort of behavior that we describe. 45 I started. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is just run through the Newton algorithm on our problem. These were the two pairs of derivatives we had for minimizing this thing. And I'm telling you, I'm giving you an artist's impression of the Hessian here, right? So if you form this matrix, identity cron B transpose B, and sort of unvectorize all the elements, because this thing doesn't really fit in there. What do I mean? Form this matrix, all the stuff you need for the top left corner of the Hessian lives in this matrix. So we can see this bit depends only on B, this bit depends only on A, and there's bits on the off diagonal of the Hessian that depend on something like the matrix of residuals at the current estimate and some other stuff to do with A and B. Now what I'm going to show you is that if you zero these off diagonal terms, you just end up with the alternation algorithm that we started with. So this is the last equation from the previous slide. And if I say, if I zero out the off diagonals and this term, I'm going to get an update, right, which is of the form, I won't go through it, you can go through it later. If you zero all these terms, the update that you get for the new x, for the a part of x, remember x is the vector of unknowns a and b vectorized, is exactly the alternation update. So it's exactly the closed form solution that you cleverly observed if you hold one of the things constant. So there was no point in cleverly observing this, right? If you just chucked it into a second order optimizer, the optimizer would have known it anyway, okay? Obviously, at the same time, it's not quite alternation, because even if I zeroed the off-diagonal terms, I would be doing this A prime equals M B star and an equivalent B prime equals M A star or A star M. I would do those simultaneously. I would lose my guaranteed progress of pure alternation. But the point I want to make is that effectively doing the inverse Hessian, doing all that computation for inverting the Hessian, if you zero off the off-diagonals, gives you something which is exactly the same speed as your alternation algorithm. So certainly the argument that it's faster is not true if you zero the off diagonals, it's not faster, but zeroing the off diagonals is removing exactly the thing that makes the Newton algorithm work well. These off diagonals hold the correlations between A and B, which mean that it converges quickly in the difficult cases. Okay. So, various conclusions from that. Small problem, definitely use some Damp-Newton or some hybrid. Some little things. If the matrix is very is very rectangular, and that can happen in some problems, then when you're inverting the Hessian, you can use the old Schur complement trick and you only have to invert the smaller, a matrix which is of size the smaller of these blocks. Effectively, the initial matrix was m by n. You can do Newton by inverting a matrix only of size m or only of size n, and if one of them is very small, then you've got a win. Another thing you can do is do some randomized process when you're dealing with the off-diagonal terms. So, for example, only work on a subset of the... these off-diagonal terms are typically summed over the rows and columns of the matrix, so only use a subset of rows and columns, as we've heard in various other talks. Okay, so what am I telling you? I'm telling you to use hybrid. It's the one that works most often, but I'm not telling you that anything works all the time. What's the final two slides? The final two slides are, here's our dinosaur data again. Here's what we're fairly sure now is the global optimum. So we've converted this into some low-rank matrix problem, found the low-rank approximation, and then we're playing back, or I'm re-rendering the full matrix, the reconstructed matrix with the, where the missing entries have been filled in. And we know from watching the video that the answer should have looked something like this. Okay, I'm fairly sure this is the global optimum, so what was my problem? Well, I set myself, I set off to optimize the wrong thing. When I found the global optimum, I get a bad result because these lines don't match up. Why did I do that? Well, it doesn't really matter, but the point is that there was a prior that I left out. There were constraints because of the geometry of this situation that said that every second row of A, every pair of rows of A should be orthonormal, should be orthogonal. So I can throw in a constraint like this. So I said I have a sort of a quartic-y kind of constraint or prior on A here, which I can throw in as a penalty term. So I'm now going to optimize this thing plus a penalty term that says I want row I and the next row of A, their dot product to be close to zero. Now, if you're using a second order optimizer, it's absolutely trivial to include this, right? You just compute a couple of extra derivatives, add them on to the gradient you already computed, and this is the answer you get. So it's trivial to add priors or to change the metrics or whatever using a nonlinear optimizer. When you do it with alternation, and especially if you're sort of tied in mentally to the alternation mindset, this bit is no longer closed form. So you end up using maybe a nonlinear optimizer to do a bit of this, or you try to... So you're now alternating nonlinear optimizations, and that's almost certainly a bad idea. Okay, I'm done. They both fail badly. Hybrid is better. It goes fast, but if you've got sparsity and you're not using it, it'll go unbelievably slowly. Thank you.